Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome back to Banal of America. We're live here again on another snowy Friday night here in New England, which is strange, I guess you could say, for April 16th, but we got a couple inches of snow this afternoon. Pretty wild. Not a fan, but what are you going to do? Tonight, we're going to have a fun conversation. I should warn you, I don't know really where we're going to go with this one. It's our old friend Jason Offit is back on the show. Of course, folks remember him on previous editions of An All America. He's been on a bunch of times. I think the first time we talked, he had just put out Darkness Walks, The Shadow People Among Us. I think that was the first time we talked. I meant to look this up and frantically tried to while the music was playing, but I'm not that fast. And, of course, he's also he wrote a travel log across a corn-swept land, which is about his trip to Canada, which I loved a lot. We had him on for that. And What Lurks Beyond the Paranormal in Your Backyard, which I wrote a blurb for. Loved that book as well. And Chasing American Monsters, which is one of my all-time faves. I think that was the last time we had him on the show. Yeah, because he was writing them over the course of time. And we had him on the beginning of when he was writing Chasing American Monsters, and then we had him on, then we had him on when he had wrapped up his work on that. So, and then, you know, things happened, life went on, things were crazy, we kind of dialed back on the show, the pandemic happened, and now, as I said, when I was starting up this spring session with the point and the goal of sort of catching up with old friends of the show, Jason Offit was at the top of the list. He can tell you this. I actually wrote to him like in February and was like, can you come on April 16th? And it was like, who the fuck knows? Who knows what's going to happen on by April 16th? But he was kind enough to put me down on his agenda here. And so here we are. We're going to catch up with Jason Offit tonight. Always love talking to him. It's one of those episodes that is very much like our conversations are always like two guys sitting at the bar. So that's pretty much what you're going to expect tonight, although I'm not drinking at the moment, but you never know. It's 2 hours, right? One of the things we're going to be talking about is I call it a new book in the description. It's new to the Banal of America listeners, I guess, because we haven't talked to Jason in a long time. But the book came out last year. It's a fiction book. So you had to build a time machine. And so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. We will definitely be paranormal. We may be paranormal adjacent at times. So, but I think no matter what happens, it's going to be a fun conversation. So welcome back to the show, Jason. It's good to talk to you, buddy.
Tim, it's been way too long. Way too long. I miss talking to you.
Yeah. It has. It really has been. It's been, I can't recall. I think the last time we chatted was the last season, and so that must have been, and it was early in the last season, the final season, quote-unquote, of Banal of America, so that would have been like 3 or 4 years ago now, which is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, we keep in touch enough. I gave you shit the other day about Boston being down in the standings, and they're up at the top now. I knew they would be.
I know. I owe you that. I owe you that. I was so disgruntled, I didn't even respond. I'm not going to even acknowledge this. I think you have, yeah, because you had written, and I think they had only lost like two or something, and then they were blown out like on the third game, and I'm like, yeah, thanks. Just getting worse, dude. Oh, man. But, yeah, what people don't know is, yeah, we keep in touch on the Twitter machine, and probably my favorite story of our correspondence on Twitter, and I think you will agree, had to be the Kansas City
I know exactly what
Chiefs.
You're talking about.
Yes, winning the Super Bowl not this past year when nefarious Tom Brady fucking did it again, but the last year, so 2020. And I don't remember the exact score, but the Chiefs were down like at least three touchdowns. And it was like fourth quarter. And poor Jason was like, I'm going to bed. Forget it. It's over. The dream's over. You know, the great journey has come to an end. And all of a sudden... and we had been going back and forth throughout the whole game. So it was like, oh, shit. So then Jason bails, and then all of a sudden the comeback starts. And I'm many beers deep, of course. It's Super Bowl Sunday, so I'm you know, many beers and wings deep. And I'm, like, frantically messaging Jason, like his house is on fire. Just like, wake up. You've got to wake up, dude. Dude, you've got to – are you asleep? Oh, dear God, I hope there's notifications. I hope your phone is going off right now. Please, for the love of God, will you wake up? Until finally,
you know,
it was like – yeah.
Yeah, a lot of times I have my notifications turned off because I don't want my phone to wake me up at night, and I hadn't turned mine off. And all of a sudden it started exploding. And it was Tim saying, God, you turn the TV on. And I thank you for that,
Tim. Yep, and then Jason finally got back
to
the game, yeah.
I turned the TV off this year, and I kept hoping you'd get a hold of me, but it never happened.
Oh, God, yeah. I don't even know what to say about this year. The Tom Brady and that Florida, they're just the Florida Patriots, let's be honest. So,
well,
you know.
They are. And you know, Kansas City's offensive line was in shambles. So, I mean, a lot of things happened. It was a perfect storm. And Tom Brady's he's the greatest of all time. So, I mean, I can't take that away from him.
Yeah, for sure. So now, as I mentioned here at the beginning of the show, you had this book, came out last summer. Folks can check it out. They get on Amazon. So you had to build a time machine. Now, is this – I was trying to keep track here. Now, is this your first outright fiction book? I don't think so, right? You've written other fiction stuff, right?
No. Yeah, right. I've got my first one was called A Funeral Story. It's about a guy who has a secret life.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, he picks up and scores with women at – strange women at funerals. A couple of zombie novels. And then I got this one, and it was a whole lot of fun to write because I love time travel. I absolutely love it. That's as a kid, those were my favorite Star Trek episodes, and I finally wrote a time travel novel. I was really happy with that.
So I have a lot of questions here about this, in a sense. So I guess. For this, in a sense, this is sort of the paranormal adjacent part, but this is what I'm interested in, and I think people, how often do we really hear from someone who writes, well, it's a paranormal show, so it's probably a lot more fiction than we think, right? But how often do we get, do we interview someone who we know is who will admit they're writing fiction? So take me a little bit, like, through the process of, like, how this happens, because it's really like it is a work of art. I mean, you're really creating like a piece of art, a story, a very long story here. So like, I guess I'm interested sort of in the process of how that works. Like, so obviously I don't want you to spoil anything with the book. So, but how did this start with the book? So what did you, come up with like a germ of an idea? Do you like have the ending already written? Do you just have the characters? Like, do you say, oh, this is an interesting person I've conjured up in my mind. Now let's take them on an adventure. You know, sort of like, what's the process for writing a novel?
All right, so every novelist has a different process.
Of course, yeah.
And, yeah, we all have, I mean, we do fit in categories, but I mean, we've all got a different process. We all write at different speeds. Watched a two-person roundtable, if you can have a two-person roundtable. It was an interview. Stephen King was interviewing George R.R. Martin, and George R.R. Martin, they were on the same stage, and he was interviewing Stephen King at the same time. So they were just asking each other writer questions. And you know, George R.R. Martin is notorious for taking for freaking ever to write his novels. And Stephen King puts out two or three a year, and that's – point blank, Martin said, "Okay, Stephen, I've got this question for you. How do you write so fucking fast?" And, you know, I mean, King really, really couldn't answer that because, again, everybody has their own way to do things. I'm watching. There are two different categories. There's plotters, and these are people who've got the beginning, middle, end. They've got their story arc down. They know when everything's going to happen. They have outlines of everything, and then they just fill in the blanks. And then there are pantsers who fly by the seat of their pants. And I'm that type. I'm not organized enough to plot, and I don't. Man, I like to discover the book like the reader does, you know, as it's happening. It's really, really bizarre how this works, and it sounds pretty damn insane. But the way you mentioned. Do I just come up with a character and let them do things? That's exactly what I do.
Okay.
For this novel, I had an idea for a character. I wanted a character who could do lots of diverse, really weird things. And I wanted a strong female protagonist. I mean, because there are not enough out there.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, so I want somebody who can do some really cool things. How did she learn how to do these cool superhero-esque things? Where would this person have grown up to learn how to do those things? And the answer that popped up was a circus. So I had a woman who grew up in the circus and learned some circus things, and now she's out on her own. And, she starts noticing weird things happening. Little bitty things like, you know, a street sign has a different name for the street. There's a shop here that shouldn't be. The name of the newspaper that's been in this town for 150 years is now something else. Little weird things like that. And she finally puts some things together with the help of some other people and discovers that time and dimensions keep flipping. And her and these people that she assembles goes out to try and stop it. But all of that stuff just stemmed from me creating a character. And for me, that is the most important thing. I mean, plot's important, setting's important, but you have to have an interesting character that somebody cares about. You know, whether it's Luke Skywalker who's, you know, an interesting good guy, or Darth Vader who's the great bad guy. I mean, you got to care about him one way or another. So whenever I do any fiction, I make sure I start off with character, and then I just sit there and let shit happen. And it's just weird how your mind lets them do things. Yeah, like I
now,
said,
you,
it sounds nuts.
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes it's not completely unheard of. That's why I kind of threw that out there I think I've heard that as a methodology, if you will. So it's not like totally foreign. This is you. Now, I don't want you to spoil the book or anything, but so as you're taking the character on this adventure, at some point do you reach a certain point in the process where you're like, okay, now all of a sudden, like when you're putting a puzzle together and all of a sudden you get to a certain point and you're like, oh, okay, now everything, now I know where everything goes. You can finish like in 30 seconds, you know what I mean? Where it's like, okay, now I know where this, I can see the picture perfectly now where all the last remaining pieces have to go. Is there like a light bulb moment? So I guess the thing is, like, how do you know when to stop? You know what I mean? Unless you kind of know the end point. Does it come to you at some point, or is it just kind of like, You know, you just keep
it
going until you reach the end. Okay.
Well, I mean, if I did that, you know, I mean, a book would be, you know, 500,000 words, because I wouldn't want to end. But yeah,
right,
I just
right.
when things happen, I try and envision what my characters are doing as if they would be in a movie, and that gives me, you know, the pacing for the chapters, you know, what happens now. What happens next?
Yeah.
So I visualize things as they're unfolding. With this one, I mean, it was kind of hard. There are a couple of my books. I had the ending in my head first before I started writing, and of course, by the time I got to the end, so much other stuff had happened that ending wouldn't work. With this one, I knew what the ending would be. It's just how to get there would, you know, was the interesting part. And what I really wanted to do, because I write humor, I'm a humorist, and I wanted to take the science fiction time travel story on a humorous jaunt, and I wanted to make fun of all the standard sci-fi tropes that are out there. And I you know, I dropped those along the way, and I tried to include as many different, because whenever they'd flip dimensions or go to a different time, I tried to throw in as many different you know, things you see in the movies that are out there, you know. And this is not spoiling anything, but you know, go to the 1950s and you know, there's a radioactive dinosaur, and everybody's like, oh yeah, shit, that's just Gorgo. You know, he just hangs around here, you know. You know, and I played with some villain tropes, because there's some stereotypical, you know, monologuing villain things that a lot of stories have. And I brought some cows, not so sacred sometimes, but sacred and occasionally, and I just made fun of them.
All right. Yeah, that makes sense. And how I noticed I think a lot of people who are writers do this. Do you have like a set time when you just, you know, you're going to write, like I said, a certain time every day, or is it kind of like when the mood strikes you? Because I've heard people say, and I mean, I write a lot for my job, so it's like I've written more now in the last like 5 years than I did ever before. So I kind of have that, in a sense, the sort of writer mentality where it's like, okay, there's a certain time of day when you're doing the writing, and you know, if it's, yeah, it's like I could probably write you a great story at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no matter what, like,
yeah,
no matter what the context or what the subject was or where I was or anything else. It's just like that's when my body hits its story writing peak. So is it something like that with you, or is it just kind of like when the mood strikes?
Well, and you know, I've gone back. I never do the mood. I mean, when I first started thinking, you know, I want to be a writer, you know, and when the mood hit me, everything flowed fine. And when the mood didn't hit me, I just didn't write.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to get anywhere. No writer's going to get anywhere doing that. And I have gone for years having a specific time to write. You know, I'm going to write 2 hours from this time to this time. It's got to be at the same desk, you know, with the same beverage in my hand, you know, maybe a pack of peanuts, you know, the same lighting, you know, everything. Maybe, you know, it's a fight scene, so I'm going to listen to Megadeth. Or, you know, it's something, you know, something a little bit more humorous, so I, you know, I might throw on some, you know, some Beastie Boys or something like that. So, you know, I've got to, you know, if I put all those things together, my brain knew, boom, it's time to write, and I knew what to
exactly
write.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, with my schedule, and I've got a six-year-old, I haven't been able to do that in a few years. So I try to make myself write every day, but it's a little bit more flexible than it used to be. I think I have a benefit that some writers don't, is because I was a journalist, a print journalist for 17 years, and
yeah,
I was used to a daily deadline. You know, the editor saying, you give me, you know, 18 inches of copy on this story in an hour. It better be done.
Right.
So when it comes to deadlines and being able to force my mind to get the work done. It hits me easier than it probably does other people just because of that training.
Right, exactly. That's kind of like what I run into with what I do. And for people who sort of get stuck or like we were saying, like the mood, sometimes it's like, sometimes you just have to write anything. And like, if you get something, even if you hate what you wrote, it's like that kind of gets you going. That's like the stretching or whatever. If it was a run,
right?
You know, that, and then you're kind of in the zone to write.
Exactly. And there have been a number of writers who've had quotes that are something like this. You know, it's easy to write. When the words are flowing, but when they're not flowing, write anyway because it's impossible to edit a blank page.
Right.
So just get, even if you're writing, you know it's shit, get something down. You can always edit it into something usable.
I forget Chris, I think is his name, in the chat. He wants to know, do you have a drink of choice for writing? Stephen King said he didn't even remember writing Cujo. Apparently he was drunk at the time. So do you have a drink of choice for writing?
You know, Stephen King, he was, I read something about him. He would read, or he would drink, he would do a couple lines of cocaine, and in the evening, he would drink a case, you know, a 2-4, 24, 16-ounce Miller Lights.
Jesus
How
Christ.
How the hell does somebody do that? But, he said, I don't remember writing Cujo at all, which is a shame, because I kind of enjoy the book. It depends. I always, would have a few beers and write. That got everything flowing. I stopped drinking for about a year and a half, and I found out I couldn't write. So I drank a shit ton of coffee and just stared at the screen. I think beer works better for me. Hey, you got to figure out what's best for you. Some people it's coffee, some it's tea, some it's Jager Bombs.
Yeah, there you go. Time travel. This is an interesting sort of realm to go down. Now, I'll move away from the book and just sort of talk about time. What is it about time travel? I mean, everyone loves time travel, right? Or I think maybe because I love time travel, so to me it's like, how could you not love time travel? It's like one of the best tropes out there. But like, what is it about time travel that sort of, what made you really want to do a time travel book?
Well, I said earlier that man, when I grew up on the original Star Trek in reruns, I would watch it 7 days a week. And, the time travel episodes were my favorite. It was just something about being able to go back the way things were and possibly change it, or go into the future and see things, how things are going to be. And get excited about that. It's being able to explore, unlike the great explorers of yesteryear, because, nobody's going to discover Antarctica. It's already there. Nobody's going to go to the North Pole. We've already done that.
Yeah.
But where else do we have to go? I mean, Indiana Jones isn't going to, dig something up. It's all these things have been discovered. So where is the one place other than outer space that we're really not ready to venture into yet? Where can we go to discover things? And that's through time. And it leaves the doors completely open to discover anything. There are so many things that I have found as an adult that I learned in history classes when I was a kid that are just freaking dead wrong. What else is wrong? I want to see what else is wrong, or I want to see what the era was when my folks grew up. They were in high school in 1954. I mean, what the hell was that like? That sounds great. Would I like to watch the premiere episode of The Twilight Zone in 1959? Hell yeah, I'd love to be there. So it's just, feeling of adventure. I don't want to go back too far. I mean, people want to go back and, see Jesus, or, see the pyramids being built. Go back to the Old West, people romanticize about
right,
you know how bad people stink back then?
Can
well,
you
that's
imagine a good
the
question.
Gym
How, what's your limit? What's your drop year on going back to?
You know what? I think I would say the 40s, but I don't want to deal with the whole World War II thing. So I think probably the 50s. I think I'd probably go there. The earliest I'd go back would probably be like 1906, 1909, whenever the Pure Food and Drug Act was passed. I think that is when the earliest I would go back. Because if we were to go back in the 1800s, we wouldn't be able to drink any water. We wouldn't be able to eat any of their food because of the bacteria and parasites. We'd be sick and, you know, we'd have, you know, dysentery.
Yeah.
It'd be like we had food poisoning all the time. So, yeah, probably... I'm going to go with the 50s or the
okay.
60s
yeah,
you meant... all the drugs.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, you want to get settled first in the
right.
But yeah, that's you raise a good point because when you were saying that, that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, okay, well, all right. Well, I'm not going to put Jason on the spot. Like, what's my it would have to be sometime within the last century. That would probably be my, you know, about a century ago. Because to me, it's like the question is. I think what I would ask myself if I were a time traveler is, okay, could I survive in this time period if the machine breaks? Maybe if I had a lot of experience and the thing held up and there was no question that this machine was going to work, but I think I'd always still be worried that if I went back to the time of the dinosaurs and it's like, I don't want to fucking get stuck. I don't want to get stuck in the time of the dinosaurs forever. You know what I mean? So it's like if I got stuck in 1930, I could probably make a go of it. I could probably make a go of it in 1930.
I could do that in 1930. I mean, it wouldn't be, you know, like the Clan of the Cave Bear. I wouldn't want to go back, you know, to see Neanderthals. And, of course, there was, you know, your Cro-Magnon, Daryl Hannah. I mean, she was okay, but you know what? She still smelled bad. I wouldn't be able to deal with any of that. Yeah, if the machine broke, you know, I'm not Doc Brown. I wouldn't be able to invent a time-traveling train. So,
exactly.
Yeah, where would I be able to survive? At least the 1950s had TV.
Right, yeah, believe me, I wouldn't be happy to be stuck in the 30s, but I could make it, you know? So, yeah, sometime around the turn of the last century-ish, yeah, I think what you're mentioning about the food and everything, that's a great point. You know, do you have one particular place you would go if you could time travel, like if you only got one shot at it? And we'll get to, there's a sort of a technical question I want to ask after that, but is there one in mind that you would go?
You mean one specific event?
I guess,
you know,
yeah,
like
or
if I would go back and, you know, try to stop, you know, Kennedy's assassination, something like that. Man.
Right, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I, that's a great question. I really don't know. You know, I'm a Anglophile. You know, I love England, the great, you know, I love Great Britain. I'd probably go back to there at some point. I don't know how cool
it
would be.
Yeah, it's hard to really
1950s.
Put your finger on. Yeah, I need some time to think about that, about what...
You know, probably Great Britain, probably England during the late 1960s, so I could watch Monty Python's Flying Circus live.
Yeah.
There's where
yeah.
I'm going.
And there you go. All right. Yeah, I don't even know where I would... I don't even know where I'd go. So, it's... You have to. So, what do you? It's. I suppose it's a scientific thing, and I don't know necessarily if this applies to the book. But where do you stand on the whole thing? Like, okay, so if we can go, let's say you go back to like 1980, I guess in some schools of thought, the idea is okay, you can never get back to the original place you came from. You can go back. You can go back to the future.
Dude,
you can go
I'm
going to
pretend you're going to edit that out, right? Are you going to edit that out?
No, that was just the natural way it came to my thoughts. So, but yeah, you can go back to where the year you came from, but you can't actually go back to that spot because things have changed just from you being there or something like that. That's sort of the idea. But then in fiction, there's a lot of elasticity with that, where, you know, there's plenty of movies where, like, people go back in time, then they come back, and, like, only one tiny thing's changed or whatever, but they can somehow seamlessly come. Let's take, like, Rick and Morty. It's like if you come, let's say I go back to 1980, and then I come back here to 2021. Is there already a Benal here in 2021, and do I have to kill him to take his spot? Like there's a lot of technical issues with time travel that are fun to talk about.
Well, right. It is. When it comes to Rick and Morty, that's why they've generally avoided time travel and they do interdimensional travel, because they didn't want to have to deal with that. When it comes to time travel, you know, the whole grandfather paradox, you know, you can't go back in time and kill your grandfather because that means you would never be born, and therefore you wouldn't be able to go back to kill your grandfather. I've always thought that was bullshit. Because, this is my second major problem with Back to the Future. The first major problem being Biff tries to flat out rape Marty's mom.
Yeah.
Why was that in the movie? I have no idea. That still blows me away. But anyway, when he's playing the guitar up on the stage, and Marty's folks are walking away from each other, and this picture that he's got, he and his brother and sister are starting to fade out. And, you know, because the folks didn't get together. And that really bothered me because, you know, Marty's there. So I've always been in the camp to where if somebody goes back to the past, they've immediately created a different future that hasn't existed to this point. The time that they came from is still out there somewhere, but, yeah, you're right. They can't ever go back to it. They're in the timeline that they're in. And even if they kill their grandpa, it doesn't matter. Grandpa, it doesn't matter because they're there. And whatever they do in that timeline is not going to affect the one they came from. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, that seems to make that makes sense to me too.
Yeah, we've got it's like a tree, you know, time being like a tree and all the branches sticking out. That makes the most sense. If there was only one timeline, we would be, you know, it would be ethically we could never time travel ever.
Yeah, I mean, it would just break down. Yeah, it would just break down. Well, it's interesting to think about. This is like that old joke, like, oh, where are the time travelers and stuff? But it's like, I don't know. It would be interesting. That's one of those things where it's like, okay, I could see aliens, like, we could find out aliens are real or Bigfoot or whatever, but time travelers is almost, like, more hard to fathom than even those fantastic ideas. Where it's like if somebody showed up and said they were a time traveler, that to me would be more mind blowing than an alien. Then it'll be like, how the what? This is real? This can really be done? Because there's a part of me that thinks like maybe our idea sort of time travel isn't even possible. Like to physically go and go walk around like down the street in London in 1960 or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like just not. You can't do it somehow. You know, but who knows?
Right. Well, and that's why I think whoever was behind the whole John Titor thing understood all this stuff.
Right.
Because are you familiar with the John Titor story?
Yeah, I'm well aware. I'm well aware of sort of the early machinations of the John Titor story. It got really weird there for a while. I think you probably know what I'm talking about. Then he came back. Or it was like there was a John Titor 2.0, a second chapter, a sequel to the John Titor thing that happened more recently, relatively. Like the whole thing came about through Art Bell, I think, and then it kind of went quiet for like a decade or so, and then the internet got involved more, and next thing you know, like, oh, John Titor was around again. So,
The thing that I think was done really well with the John Titor story is that he said, whoever it was that was behind that, said that I traveled back in the past knowing that when I went home. I wouldn't be going home because there's another timeline that I'm in, and I can never go back to the exact home that I was from, which is exactly what we're talking about. Yeah, because when you go, if you can go back in time, whatever changes you make, I mean, seriously, that shit already happened.
Yeah.
Even if it's in the future, it's still already happened. I mean, but all this is, you know, all sorts of, you know, debate that goes around in circles. The one main problem I've always had with time travel is that would make it impossible would be that when you travel, if somebody can travel backward or forward in time, it doesn't matter. They should reappear in the exact spot in the universe that they disappeared from. And because the Earth's revolving,
it's
rotating,
saying, yeah.
It's going around the sun, the Milky Way's spinning. If we were to go anything farther than a few seconds, we would end up in space.
Right.
You know, we'd be
right.
In the vacuum of space.
Yes, yes. You need like an anchor. You need some kind of technological anchor to pull the thing back to the planet. And it's like, yeah, no one ever talks about that. But you're absolutely right. Because it's like, yeah, if you left the Earth and then you can't get back to the spot in space where you left from. It's like virtually impossible.
Right. You would have to be able to, you would have to travel a very short distance in time and be in a spaceship. that's it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, yeah, time traveling train, not happening. So,
not happening.
Yeah. So, I don't remember. Does the train fly at the end?
Yes.
How does it just disappear into the ether on the tracks?
No. It flies off into the sky at the end, like the DeLorean did in the first movie.
Oh, I think I saw the third one like once, and. It was like
it's
this
not
isn't
a
even
good
a
movie.
Yeah, it was like all the intriguing time travel stuff's taking a backseat to like this westerny, you know, shtick that we're doing here.
The best part of that movie is ZZ Top. That's the best part. ZZ Top was the band at the the 1868 festival
ZZ Top, they are, that makes sense. There's a cameo by ZZ Top. I really haven't seen the movie in forever, I think, because to me it was like, I want to watch Back to the Future, not Back to the Future as a Western. This doesn't even like, there was no need, I don't know who was thinking, I would love to know the thinking behind that, because there was no need to add, to make that movie a Western. It just completely complicates things, but. You know, unless you're going to jump off and then start doing, like, that's in a different atmosphere every time. You know, if you're going to do a franchise or something. But I don't know if that was really
What I did with my book. That's basically I did with my book. I hit with every place that they jumped, I went to another type of dimension where a dimension or time either where, you know, like the Nazis won World War II or... You know, they went back to the 1950s where, the kaiju monsters were everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then again, I was poking fun at stuff, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's your universe to explore, so that's the good thing. Yeah, I never really thought about that part about getting back to Earth, but you're absolutely right about that. So, here's what I think. If they ever have time travel, this is what it'll be. Some kind of, like, observation. Like, cause a lot of people think, the aliens are, UFOs. I use them interchangeably because I'm lazy and old school. So, but, and I'm intellectually honest enough to admit that when people say UFO, they mean fucking alien. So, all right.
Linda Moulton Howe. She will chew your ass.
Oh, my God. A lot of UFO world will. Well, actually, if you mean... Okay, relax, guy, all right? I'm just using it interchangeably. So, oh, my God. So, but a lot of people say, oh, the UFOs, this is what they are. I do think that this is possible, maybe, that they'll come up with some, like, have you heard of, there was an Italian, I think it was a priest, but I'm not sure. It was like Father Coroni's Coronavisor or something like that. Have you heard that story?
Yeah, Father Ernetti's Coronavisor.
Yes, which
Father
now
Ernetti.
In 2021, the Coronavisor sounds like something I don't want. So, who knows?
But it was Crona, C-H-R-O, like Kronos, the Greek titan of time.
I know.
Not Corona as in crown. And yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah.
Man, you gotta
edit sounds
the
a little
shit
too...
out of this, Tim.
What?
I said you gotta edit the shit out of this.
No, dude, this is what people want to hear. So this is I said this was like bar talk. This is what it is. This is
it
us,
is totally bar talk.
Catch it up. So this is the. So for people who don't know, so Father Ernetti. He allegedly, this was the story, this was, I don't know when this came out, go and Google it, folks, you'll find out the skinny on this.
I think it was the 90s.
The book came out.
Oh, I just remember Art Bell talking about it.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember when it came about in the first place. But long story short, folks, is that there was this guy, this priest, who allegedly built a time machine that was like a machine to watch time, essentially, like a TV. It was like a TV to watch the past. I think maybe they might be able to come up with something like that, that people will be able to use in the past. Here, I'm on Amazon. Apparently, I own the book. It tells me this is creepy and enlightening at the same time. It says you last purchased this item on June 19th, 2003. So apparently
I just looked it up and it was a 2002 book.
Uh-oh. No. It's the paperback says 2000, but either way, I'm moderately terrified that Amazon knows that I purchased this book 18 years ago. which is, they know it better than I do. I don't even know where the fucking book is, but apparently I own it. So, yeah, he was an Italian Benedictine monk who claims to have created this Coronavisor, which was a machine he could use to look into the past. And for people, it was written by Peter Crossa, who I am completely unaware of. And I couldn't tell you, and maybe you could speak to this, I have no idea if this story is true or not, but it was foisted onto the world as a true story. There was no, like, this wasn't like, oh, here's a fantastic tale of time travel written by this guy. Like, this was alleged to have been true, from what I understand.
Right. I mean, there have been, it's been disproven. I mean, this was all fiction, which is unfortunate.
I would assume so, yeah.
Because that's really cool. The picture of Jesus that was supposedly taken with the Coronavisor, there's a statue of Jesus somewhere, and it's a picture of the statue. But if any sort of time travel were created, this would be probably the least intrusive, I think, because you couldn't physically go back and try and kill Hitler. And frankly, I think that would be the worst idea, because out of all the evil people in his regime, he was the dumbest. There were so many more evil people below him who were a lot smarter than he was, and things might have ended up a lot worse. But when it comes to time travel, it's the science of it. And I have a friend who is a scientist. He's a physicist, and he read my book, and he told me that I got all the interdimensional and time travel things, at least according to current theories, I got them right. So,
So afraid
kudos
where that was going.
Me. I don't. If I write something, I want to make sure, even if it's absolutely bug shit crazy, I want to make sure it's right, at least. physically. I mean, I hate it. Like the movie Eraser with Schwarzenegger. Did you ever watch that?
No.
Which is it's okay. It's a fun action movie. But there's a the door of a jetliner comes open and he's holding on to stay in, and the last parachute gets sucked out, and like 30 seconds later he lets go and goes out, and he catches the parachute. You know, that's basically, you know, physics. Things drop at the same rate. There's no way in hell he would catch it, especially because of the fact that he's got more wind resistance and the fact that after 30 seconds he was probably 20 miles away from it. But
yeah,
you know, the point is, I want to get things right. And with the scientist, I got that right. But other than the science, it's the ethics that really, really, really get to me. With the coronavisor, if that thing existed, and it was existed, or it was invented simply, I want to look back in time. You know, it was invented by a priest. We're going to look back and watch Moses part the Red Sea. We're going to watch.
Right, yeah. Birth of Christ.
Yeah, we're going to watch all of this stuff. We're going to watch Jesus. You know, we're going to watch all that. But technology doesn't stay in one place. You know, what would happen if that got out? What would people use that technology for? You know, I can see, totalitarian state or a state that's not totalitarian becoming that way because they have this technology and can look back into everybody's past. We've all done bad things.
Oh, yeah, I see what
every
you're saying.
Single
yeah.
one of us. Yeah. So,
oh, yeah.
I mean, that sort of technology in the hands of a government, it's a 1984 thing. We'd all be fucked.
I don't know if you explore that in the book, but there's a time travel book for you, like the government.
I don't. Maybe
a
maybe I'll
a time
do that
machine.
Next.
Yeah, and,
okay,
and everyone lives in constant
Copyright
fear
Kennedy.
That their past is gonna be. Yeah, you could have like a whole council of people or some shit that like fire up the machine and yeah, that would be interesting.
Or
yeah,
you know,
well,
it could be something as simple as like a background check for a new job.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read this book. We're talking about sort of fantastic ideas for books and stuff. Postmortal by Drew McGarry. Have you heard of that book?
No, I have not.
You should check it out. I like it a lot, and I'm not a huge fiction fan. He's a sports writer. He used to write for Deadspin, but he wrote a couple novels, and in the book is about it's like kind of written as a diary. It's like a found footage almost kind of book where it was like this is scrapings together of blog posts and this guy's live journal and other stuff. This is his story. And it's like in the future they invent like a shot or whatever or a pill or a treatment that like freezes you in time at your age. So yeah, and then the story is sort of like how it affects this guy and how it affects society as a whole, and it's really fascinating because he takes a lot of the ideas and goes to like really crazy places with them that, like, it quite frankly, if I had one critique of the book, it was like I care less about the actual antics of the main character as much as I really want to hear more about what's happening in the world, and he kind of only touches on it at random points. But it's like, you know, Russia has amassed a, you know, an army of super soldiers that an immortal army. And, you know, and then it's like then all of a sudden it turns out they're running into all these problems because they have like an 8 million man army that they have no, you know, they can't feed them. They don't know what, so all of a sudden they start breaking apart and there's rogue elements of the army and stuff like that, and it's like a lot of wild stuff like that where you're like, oh, I never really even, yeah, how would this affect things? So yeah, I recommend that book to folks.
All right, Mortal. I just clicked on it I just went on Amazon and clicked on it, man. Thank you for the recommendation.
Right. I think you'll like it a lot. It's really it's one I I enjoy quite a bit. So How to Build a Time Machine is your book, of course. We want people to go and get that. There is a banal reference in the book. So Jason has held up his promise. He's kept the promise to ingratiate Banal into the Offit verse, which is good.
Well, and Tim, let me just tell you, my next book that's coming out this year is a horror novel called The Girl in the Corn. And in it, you're not necessarily in it, but the main characters steal a car that is from that the car is they trace it back to a Tim Banal from Worcester, Massachusetts.
There you go. I love it.
So
I love it.
Your car is stolen. I hope you never owned a 1974 Nova that got stolen.
No, I did not. No.
Okay.
But maybe I'll have to. Maybe that's one of those things that'll if the book gets turned into a movie, maybe I'll get the car somehow as a tribute to the some roundabout way.
That would be awesome. Yeah, 1974 Nova. You know, it's not a bad car. I'm just saying.
I'm sure. Yeah. You know, I don't know much about the 70s. That's one time I would like to go back and check out.
Yeah, it's yeah, the 70s were kind of weird. My car is a 70s car. I own a 1975 Ford Elite, which is you know what a Gran Torino, the Starsky and Hutch car?
Vaguely.
Yeah, this is the better version of that, and by better I mean it's I know it's got electric seats and, you know, a couple of bells and whistles, but it's basically that car.
Interesting. You drive that every day?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hard to maintain?
It is because it wasn't in all that great a condition when I bought it, so I've had to put some money in it to get it to where I can actually drive it every day.
Yeah.
Well, and right now the turn signals don't work. So it's lucky I live in a really small town, so it doesn't matter because everybody knows where I'm going. I owned a 1976 Gran Torino in high school, and I talked about it all the time, and we needed a new car, and my wife's like, would you just fucking get that car and shut up about it? So, yeah, thanks, honey.
Nice. All right.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Damn. You're a man of many surprises, Jason Offit. So that's the book.
One of my first students who saw the car, they're like, Jesus Christ, Jason, that's the car to go hunt demons in. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? It is. Let's do it.
Well, it's got character, and it stands out from all the other cars on the road because it's like, shit, almost 50 years old now. So
yeah.
That's pretty awesome. Can you bring it to car show? They have them here. Do they have them where you are? Ice cream shop, and they all come out and fucking hang out for the afternoon out in the parking lot and get in my way when I'm trying to buy cigarettes at the gas station?
Well, I was thinking, you buy cigarettes at the ice cream shop? No, it's at Burger King. That's where we have ours.
Oh, nice.
Burger King parking lot, yeah.
Yeah. They are pretty cool, though.
I actually once wrote a short story involving time travel about a guy who went to the past. He was having, he knew his wife was going to dump him. He was just down and out. He was feeling terrible. And he looked up this service that offered time travel. Time travel was illegal. And so he paid a bunch of money, and they sent him back in the past. All he wanted to do was buy his car from high school. That was it. He wasn't looking for anything else. So he, just bought his car from high school. I have a soft spot for old cars.
Yeah. No, it's cool. I think my first my first car was probably an 80-something Chevy Cavalier. And it was just like you're just a boxy fucking right off the assembly line. Nothing particularly sexy about it at all. I think if I brought it back, it would be, it would sort of be like 8-bit, you know, like that, like when you see something that's in 8-bit computer graphics.
Definitely.
You know, you're just kind of like, that's kitschy and neat, but it's not really like cool. It's just kind of like, oh, it's not quite retro enough to be cool just yet. So yeah, Chevy Cavalier.
Was it 2-door or 4-door?
I think it was a 4-door. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was a 4-door.
That's
it was like
worse.
A 1986. It was like light blue. You know, it was not. It was like a, looking back on it now, it was like riding around in like a dune buggy almost. It was not really.
Yeah.
You know, it was just fucking a hunk of metal and a couple of bucket seats and. None of that. I think it had the airbags, but I couldn't tell you if it did, to be honest with you. So I think at some point
you know,
they made everybody get the airbags.
Probably the person, you know, who worked at Mattel suggested, you know, one of those for a Hot Wheels car. Was probably fired on the spot.
I would assume so, yeah.
Yeah.
So now somebody so when I announced the show here, Someone, he may be listening right now, so this guy Scott Cunningham said he actually had a fairly detailed question, so I wanted to ask this here. So he says, Offutt sort of launched his paranormal career, if I remember correctly, on the whole black-eyed kid femno, which I guess is short for phenomenon. So
yeah.
I didn't know we were doing that now, but apparently we are.
Or maybe
so
it
we'll
was
start
that
over.
Early 2000s weight loss drug, you know. It might have been it.
Yeah, so Offutt sort of launched his paranormal career, if I remember correctly, on the whole black-eyed kid femno. Ask him if the first report doesn't correlate time-wise to the X-Files episode that first used the black-eyed imagery with the alien virus black oil. Does that ring any bells for you?
Oh, my gosh. I definitely remember that episode. I remember that episode. I can see the name, or not the name. I can see the name. I can see the face of the Russian double agent who was infected with it.
Yeah, he has a picture up there too. He has a picture of a little kid that has. Yeah.
And then there was a little kid got it, and it rolled over the eyes, smokily rolled over the eyes. But I think the X-Files went off the air in 99, maybe something like that. 2000. I don't know this, the whole black eyed kids, and he's sort of right. I latched onto the black eyed kids things, fairly early on. I started out more with ghosts and shadow people, but, the person who, launched the black eyed kids, you know, trope, was a guy named Brian Bethel. He's a journalist from Texas, and he encountered them, and he wrote his encounter on a message board back in like 98, maybe 99. And that might have been about the time that happened, you know, the whole X-Files thing. But I interviewed Brian, and that scared the shit out of him. I mean, he sounded scared. I believed him when he told me his story.
Yeah. Yeah,
but, I mean,
it makes
also,
sense.
I mean, vampire movies with those, you know, with black eyes like that as well. So, I mean, that's going back a few years. It's been around for a while.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's like, how can... there's no way to really answer that question, in a sense, where it's like, how should we... We don't know. I mean, maybe that thing had some influence on that taking hold in the zeitgeist, but maybe that was already something that was out there. I mean, it's definitely an eerie sort of connection. So, but to me, I guess what I was wondering in a way, and I mentioned this to you today when I was setting up the show, was it definitely seems like Black Eyed Kids It seemed like it maybe now, with the benefit of hindsight, it looks like more like some kind of passing phenomenon in a way. Like, I don't know. I don't really hear any black eyed kid stories anymore at all. And it was like, I felt like they were kind of, they were definitely a big thing for a while.
Yeah, for a while, they definitely were. I wrote a ton of them. And I was going to write a book on Black Eyed Kids before, God, what's his name, Weatherly, David Weatherly did. And my wife was like, you know, Jason, none of the things you write about really freak me out, except for these things. So if you write about Black Eyed Kids and they come knocking on my door, our door, it's your ass. So
yeah.
I didn't write the book. Yeah, but when it comes to the Black Eyed Kids, yeah, you're right. There were tons of experiences, tons of stories, and then they kind of disappeared. I've thought about this a lot over the years. And you know, I took a step back from the paranormal, and
right,
I only
right.
came back whenever I did my book on monsters, Chasing American
mm-hmm.
Monsters. I am more of the, I don't know if I want to say belief, or at least logically this is putting things together, that there are entities or energies, whatever you want to call them out there, that tap into what humanity's thinking about. Whatever we put our energy into, our thoughts into, that maybe these things catch a hold of that.
Yeah.
And because when the Black Eyed Kid phenomena started, boom, I mean, they were everywhere. It was the same when I wrote my book on Shadow People. I saw Shadow People in the 70s when I was a little kid, and I didn't hear anything about them until Art Bell started talking about them on Coast to Coast in like 93 or, you know, something like that. And then I was working on my book, and I just got hundreds of people contacting me with their own Shadow People stories. And,
yeah.
and that seems to happen whenever people notice something. I mean, there was a big Bigfoot wave in the late 60s,
right.
early 70s. You know, and certain types of UFOs are seen at certain times. And at this time, you know, between these years and these years, lots of ghosts. So this is
yeah, like Chupacabra. That was another
unknown.
One that had sort of its 15 minutes of fame.
Exactly. I mean, all I'm doing is, and this happened with Slender Man, which was a completely fictitious character that was done for a website that had a contest. But I talked to people who seem to me, honestly, that they believe that they've encountered that thing. So,
yeah.
And again, I'm answering an unknown with an unknown, but there may be, like I said, entities or energies or something that kind of feed in to, you know, popular thought, and whatever is popular at that time, you know, tends to appear. I mean, that's,
yeah.
Because it happens like that. It comes in waves. It always has.
Yeah, yeah. I'm in agreement with you on that. And someone in the chat, same guy. He's the only one in the chat. So Chris in the chat.
Oh, man, you didn't have to tell me that, Tim.
he says, what if black-eyed kids were a thought form or tulpa and only appear when enough people think about them? That's kind of like what we're saying. I'm kind of in agreement on that, where it's like, that seems like the most logical explanation. I think when people take that idea and then they misconstrue it, where people are like, well, no, you're saying it's not real, or it's a mass hallucination or something. I don't necessarily think that's the case. I just think that, like, somehow, like you're saying, like, this thing exists in the zeitgeist, and whatever this, kind of like what Greg Bishop talks about with the co-creation hypothesis, whatever this thing is in the ether, you know, they pick up on that resonance of Black Eyed Kids, and they manifest as Black Eyed Kids. And after a while, it kind of dies out, and it picks up on whatever else people are concerned about. You know, phantom clowns,
yeah.
Something like that.
Well, right, yeah, I'm glad you threw that out there. I mean, I grew up in a time when, you know, I mean, the phantom clowns were a thing in Kansas City. I mean, and it was at the same time they were in Pennsylvania and on the East Coast, you know, up in the Northeast,
yeah.
You know, because, I mean, I know Lauren's written about this stuff, but I remember as a kid, I mean, there were news stories in our local paper, the Kansas City Star, about clowns in white vans trying to abduct kids. They never did. But, I mean, we were scared shitless to walk outside. Whenever we saw a white van, it was like, oh, my God, it's the clowns.
But yeah, yeah.
That would definitely fit into that category.
I have a friend, God rest his soul, Joe Cosentino. He passed away a few years ago. But he insisted, I wish he was still around, period, but I wish he was still around post this new Phantom Clown thing so I could get him on the show to tell the story, because he insisted that he had a Phantom Clown encounter as a kid at the reservoir in our town here. And he was so sure of it, he actually got a tattoo of a clown. Like a menacing clown. So he was a bit of a confabulist, so we can't necessarily rule out that this all worked the opposite direction, that he was like, you know, it'd be cool, a creepy clown tattoo, and then the story kind of came to him later, but his story was that he saw a creepy phantom clown and he got the tattoo of the clown. So, you know, I did know someone who really genuinely claimed to have had one of those experiences. You know, I got to ask his brother about that and see if he, I think his brother was there. I don't know if he saw the clown too or what. So, but now that reminds me, I hadn't thought about it. I thought about my friend's phantom clown experience. Yeah, Black Eyed Kids. We'll see. We'll see if they make a comeback, I guess. I don't know what would be the thing now anyway. People can't even leave the house or anything. How did you, without getting, like, too dark or whatever, but, like, how did you find the pandemic? You know, what was your experience the last year? And, you know, was it, you know, what was your experience like this past year? Because I haven't talked to you in a while. So what, you know, how did you find the pandemic now that it's practically over?
I honestly don't really want to answer that question, Tim.
Uh-oh, why?
Well, I'm going to tell you why, because during the pandemic, well, first, I'm a reclusive shut-in.
So am I.
I'm an introvert.
So it was like, yeah. So I really wasn't really affected by the pandemic. So I feel kind of weird.
Is my life changed? Not really. It's not really changed. I don't go out anyway. So I had that, I had, you know, How to Build a Time Machine, or not How to Build a Time Machine, but You Had to Build a Time Machine came out to really good reviews. I got my next novel accepted by my publisher, which is the horror novel, A Girl in the Corn, which is coming out in the fall. You know, I had that stuff happen. Nobody I knew caught COVID. Oh, well, I know I knew. I had one buddy, but, I mean, he got over it fairly fast. I had a great 2020, and I just feel terrible because so many people didn't.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat, and I feel bad. I feel guilty, like, saying it, but, yeah, I thought, you know, I talked about this with Tyler Kochan a few weeks ago. We were doing the anniversary show, but it was like, you remember, I don't know what it was like in Missouri, but here in Massachusetts, there was this brief window, like around the start of the summer to like the end of the summer, where pretty much things were almost back to normal. And we had to wear a mask, and like, it was all the general rules. And it was like, nobody could really leave the state, but no one could really come to the state either. So it was like all the shit you ever wanted to do in the summer in Massachusetts, you could do without dealing with anybody else. I went to Plymouth Plantation by myself, and I was the only one walking around Plymouth Plantation. Me and seven or eight people forced to portray pilgrims or whatever. I find those people so fascinating. I just want to know more about them, but it's like it's trying to like hug a mime. It's like they won't. Yeah. They won't. Break character ever, and it's like, no, you don't understand. I want to know what life is like as a pretend pilgrim. That's what I want to know, not what life was like as a fucking pilgrim.
Castle. Come on, smile.
Exactly. But yeah, so yeah, the pandemic, it was awful and terrible and shit, but I managed to, you know, skate by as well. So yeah.
It was great. Like I said, I feel, you know, really bad having a great 2020, but you know, I'm
it is
what
it
I
is.
Say? It is what it is.
I did find the whole experience, like, it was very apocalyptic just watching it all on TV and shit. It was like, this is like, I don't necessarily like it when the world resembles an apocalyptic film, for obvious reasons. So,
right.
when you know, there were all these scenes of, like, the one thing that will always stick with me is Mecca. There was, like, pictures of Mecca, because apparently Mecca, otherwise, is always packed. But because they shut it down, like, you could see the white floor. There's a giant, like, circle thing, and like, the Muslim people all congregate there and pray, and like, that's the meeting place. That's the center or whatever. And I'm not doing this justice in any way at all, folks, so I apologize if I get things wrong. But the gist of it is there's this place, and it has, like, an all-white floor, and it's outdoors. And it has, like, an all-white tile floor, but you almost can never see the floor because so many people are there congregating and praying and pilgrimaging to Mecca. And there was these pictures where it was like, it was like that everywhere. It was like all these empty places, just empty, this emptiness. It was really, you know, it was creepy. It was this, like, end of the world. You got kind of a glimpse of, like, what it would be like, which is, it was really kind of freaky.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to sound awful, but it's been kind of neat living through a pandemic.
No, you're absolutely right. I won't disagree with you whatsoever. And it is, yeah. It can be both. It can be terrible and also fascinating, right? I mean, you
okay,
know, I think
yeah,
that's
I'll give
fair.
You that, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, thank you for making me not sound like such an, you know, shithead.
No, you're not saying it was fun. It was by no means fun. Believe me, I would rather have had a regular fucking year. I think everybody would have had a regular year. But it was like, okay, well, if we're going to experience this, you know, it's pretty interesting to see how this is happening. So yeah, no, I'm in agreement with you on that.
It might have registered differently if my parents were alive, which they're not. They died long before this. So if I had, you know, my parents to deal with COVID, them being old, I think it would have been a lot more stressful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Believe me, people, yeah. No, it was not pleasant for a lot of people, and I feel bad for all those folks, obviously. But,
Jesus,
yeah.
Tim, thanks for making me talk about my dead parents, man.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
It was great. No, I'm kidding.
As someone
no,
else
I mean, they
the
are
Johnson,
dead, but...
When lockdown came, I was excited that my lifestyle had become a government mandate. So yeah, that's pretty much
yeah.
it. You know. Yeah, it was an interesting experience.
This is why, you know, like the 1918 Spanish flu, you know, pandemic sucked so much, and they didn't have the internet. You know, if you were stuck
stuck
home.
Well, that was the thing. Like, look it, okay? There's a lot of, like, the thing was fucking terrible. No one's, we can set that aside. This is sort of like when you're talking about a serial killer. Where it's like, okay, well, my favorite serial killer, where it's like, okay, well, you know, you got to always put that up ahead first, right? Okay, he was a terrible fucking person, but the most interesting is whatever. So, like, yes, it was a fucking horrible, just awful. It was a plague. But now I lost my train of thought, setting up the pre-apology. But, yeah, it was... an interesting experience to live through. That's for sure. And
I think the thing that about the whole pandemic that it really bothered me is, I mean, I knew human beings were selfish, and I knew we were overall mean to each other, mainly because we are selfish. But I mean, watching that unfold, I live in a small town. We're like almost 13,000 people, not quite. Whenever the university's not in session, the population goes down. And we're in a rural area, and there was such a fight with our city council deciding, you know, we're having a mask mandate. You know, this we don't want, you know, to have a lot of problems here. So, you know, we have social distancing. We're requiring it. You know, everybody's going to wear these masks, and you're just going to deal with it. You can't go into a business without a mask. And so many people were fighting it. We had one business owner who recently ran for city council who made it viral, you know, back in the summer, because on his business, which is a restaurant/bar, he put a sign on the front door saying, "No masks allowed."
Oh boy! Yeah,
It was like, yeah, we've got all these people wanting, you know, to not spread the virus, and then we've got all these assholes who don't care.
Yeah,
it's my right to spread the virus.
Yeah, the mask thing was just ridiculous. Luckily, people got in line pretty well here in Massachusetts because we got hit with the pandemic pretty bad right away, so it was like people kind of woke up to it pretty fast. But yeah, in these other parts of the country, it's crazy. It's really, it was disappointing.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens, what kind of radio show is this?